Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome you all to the courtroom for our second argument in November. And we especially welcome two groups of students. The Valley Christian School. Would those students please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And we thank the instructor, too. And we welcome Wisconsin Valley Lutheran School. Would those students please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a program sponsored by the Wisconsin Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. We invite students from across the state to join us for an oral argument. If the student decides to come, we send materials relating to this case. The students may engage in some activities centered on the case. They come, listen to oral argument, and at the end of this argument, they will be joined by other students who were here earlier, and a justice is assigned to talk to the students that day about the procedures of the court in accepting a case for review and how we handle deciding the case. The substantive issues of the case are not discussed. Counsel and anyone else in the courtroom are invited to join the students in that discussion after this case is completed. Now, we have summaries of this case. It's easier to listen and understand the argument if you know something about the facts or issues of law. So if you would like a summary of the case, if you'd raise your hand, the marshal will give you a summary. While the marshal is doing that, let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Robinsack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. And to her right, Justice David Prosser, with whom you will meet after this case is concluded. And on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I will call our second and last case for today, 09AP246, Deanne Phillips versus U.S. Bank National Association. Before I ask counsel to stand and start the case, I have two announcements. One, there's an empty seat, and I called the justice's name. But that justice will not participate. I would like to tell counsel that I have, my family has two trusts, of which U.S. Bank is the trustee. And I have had prepared for me a list of all the appearances and all of the witnesses. And this list, I don't know anybody on this list, so I have no personal familiarity or relationship, as best I can tell, with anyone who has come before the proceedings, and that includes depositions. If on further examination of this record, it will appear that I do personally know people so that the issue of credibility, et cetera, is a matter that comes before the court, I will withdraw from participation. This is to put you all on alert. With that, I'll call Bradley C. Fulton, who represents a U.S. Bank National Association.
Good morning, Your Honors. Once again, I am Brad Fulton from DeWitt Ross and Stevens, and along with my partner, Mindy Rowland, have the pleasure of representing U.S. Bank before you. May it please the court. We're here today because Ms. Phillips wants to be paid a bonus after her employment was terminated by U.S. Bank. She wants to be paid this bonus despite the fact that the bonus plan document itself informs her that she is not eligible for consideration of the bonus if she is no longer employed by the bank. The operative language can be found on page 41 of our appendix and provides, in order to encourage employee retention, participants whose employment with the company is terminated, voluntarily or involuntarily for reasons other than position elimination, prior to the date of actual payment, are ineligible for an award, except as required by state law or specifically provided in the performance measures document. Now, we know Ms. Phillips' position was not eliminated. We know there's nothing under state law that prohibits a provision like this, and we know there's nothing in the performance measures document to modify this provision. Instead, what Ms. Phillips is asking you to do is to rewrite this provision to provide an exception for termination decisions made in bad faith. To do this, of course, requires this court to create a novel cause of action and find that an implied duty of good faith and fair dealing exists to invalidate the expressed written terms of this discretionary bonus plan. There are three principal problems with this. First and foremost, we have the plan documents themselves. The plan documents specifically inform Ms. Phillips that she was not eligible upon termination. The plan documents specifically informed Ms. Phillips that it was not modifying the at-will nature of her employment. She could be terminated for any reason or no reason at all. How can we have an implied duty not to do something that the documents specifically allow the bank to do? Now, this court hasn't had occasion to address this issue, but the Court of Appeals has in the SuperValue case, in the M&I case, in the Wausau Medical Center cases cited in our briefs. And those cases all say you cannot use this cause of action for implied duty of good faith and fair dealing, or breach of that implied duty, to argue against something that is specifically called for in the contract documents.
So you have an employee at will, but there's a contract too. Is that right?
Well, here
is that what this case is about?
Well, there's not a contract that modifies the employment at will
relationship. No, but there's an employee at will. We agree. And fire at will, right? But there's also a contract here, right?
Yes, there's a document that outlines the bonus plan.
Right. And so what we're not debating here is the right to fire this employee, right?
That's correct.
He can be fired for any cause.
Yes.
What we're debating is whether the bank owes any money under these other documents.
That is correct.
So you can have a contract within an employment at will. You have pension plans, you have profit sharing plans, you have health insurance plans, all of which are contractual, even though you have an employee at will, right?
Yes.
Okay. Just wanted to clarify the issue.
Where the court has had occasion to deal with similar employee benefit plans like this, the court has rejected similar claims.
I thought, unless I misunderstood your arguments in your brief, I thought you said that this was not a contractual relationship because it was illusory.
Well, we can call it illusory. We can call it discretionary. And the language is very clear that the bank could have determined at any given point that Ms. Phillips was no longer eligible for the bonus. Now, it brings me to an important point here. The bank did not have to terminate Ms. Phillips if it did not want to pay her this bonus. It could have exercised her discretion and determined that she was no longer an employee in good standing. It could have exercised its discretion and determined that her performance was not satisfactory. Or it could have, like the performance measures document calls for, specifically said that Ms. Phillips is no longer eligible for this bonus. Okay, it did not do that. But what Ms. Phillips is asking you to do is interject this implied duty of good faith and fair dealing into all of those decisions.
I need assistance with this because I see this case as you can fire for a good reason, bad reason, any reason as long as it's not illegal, but that's not what this case is about. This case is about whether or not the incentive plan and the private asset management group plan, this case is about whether or not these other plans form or do not form a binding contract. It seems to me that's what this case is about. And if it, and whether or not in, if it is a contract, it seems axiomatic that in all contracts there is a duty of good faith and fair dealing, but that's separate, if there is a contract, that's separate from being able to fire an employee at will for good reason, bad reason, good faith, bad faith. You can have all the bad faith in the world as long as it's not illegal and fire someone, I think. Is my paradigm of what this case is about correct?
Well, I don't think it's entirely separate. True, Ms. Phillips has not brought a wrongful discharge claim and is seeking reinstatement. But she's asking this court to allow her to proceed with a cause of action that the court has rejected time and time again, which is to let her try the reasons for her termination. Okay, what about all these profit-sharing plans out there that require you to be employed on December 31st in order to receive your profit-sharing contribution? Or a stock option award that vests 20% each year for 5 years? Is every employee who's terminated leading up to either the vesting or the payment allowed?
Then you have to interpret those pension and profit-sharing plans, don't you?
You do have to interpret those, yes.
So we have to interpret, one, is there a contract? Not relating to her employment, but relating to bonus or commission, health care, pension. You have to, is there a contract? That goes to the illusory issue. Assuming that there is a contract, you have to interpret the terms of the contract. What does it mean, right?
Correct.
And three, do you agree that as a general contract rule, all contracts have an understanding of good faith? As a general contract rule, take it outside of employment. As a general rule, right?
Yes.
Okay. So as a general rule, there's a good faith concept. And then the question is, do you still have a good faith concept, if I hear you right, do you still have a good faith concept in this extraneous contract, this other contract, when you have an employee at will? Is it fair to state that?
Yes, I think
in that way?
I think that separates the issues appropriately.
Does that nuance Justice Bradley's questions to you?
Yes, I think that nuance.
Fine. Yes. Okay. And my question is only, you can have a contract even if you have an at-will employee, because the contract deals with particular aspects of the employment, right?
Yes.
Okay. So is this illusory?
Yes, I believe that it is.
Okay, tell us about that, if you would.
Well, the bank at any time could have simply determined that Ms. Phillips individually was no longer eligible for the bonus. Mm-hmm. The bank controlled the means, right. 100%.
Is that a unilateral contract? I tell you I'm going to give you $100 if you walk out of that door right now. But if I get you between now and the door and say, I withdraw it, that's not illusory.
If you get
$100.
If the contract also tells me that you can pull it off the table at any point prior to walking out the door, then I think that's illusory.
Oh, you think it's illusory?
If you tell me that you can pull it off the table at any given point before I walk out that door, it's not a contract
But if you walk out that door, do you get my $100 before I withdraw it?
Before you pay it to me?
Pardon me?
If you tell me that you can choose not to pay me at any given time, that's illusory.
No, I didn't say that. I'd say I can withdraw my offer to pay you $100 if you walk out the door. But if you walk out the door before I withdraw my offer, you get $100. This is true of all these lotteries. It's true of various games that are played. They can withdraw at any time. They can withdraw 10% off at a department store anytime. But if you go and you satisfy those requirements, you get 10%. That's the deal.
it, but that's not the facts we have before us.
Well, tell us, what are the facts?
Well, I think, counsel, to put a sharper point on Madam Chief Justice's walking out the door hypothetical, perhaps you are looking at that same page 41 of the appendix, the line that says, prior to the date of actual payment. That's the policy.
That's exactly right.
Compare and contrast with what the Court of Appeals wrote, and I'm going to ask you to address this because I think it fits in quite nicely with the discussion you were just having. Where the Court of Appeals opinion at page 8, where the court said, here U.S. Bank contracted to pay employees benefits under the plan so long as the employees fulfilled the plan's prerequisites and were employed. Now, this is the phrase the court used. When payment of those benefits were due. But that's not the actual language of the plan as I read it.
It's not the language of the plan.
What is the distinction? Why is that a difference with a distinction?
Well, it's a significant difference because no payments are ever due under these plan documents. No benefits are ever earned or accrued. Instead, under the performance measures document, it identifies how the bonuses may be computed. But the overall plan document says that we can choose to terminate this plan at any time. We can choose to amend its terms at any time, which may alter or preclude, I believe, but alter any award due any that otherwise might be paid to an individual. All this plan does is tell you that if you do these things, you may be eligible for a bonus. You may be eligible. That's if the Chief Justice had told me, if you walk out that door, I might give you $100, then we're more in line with the facts of this case. Because at any given time, she can decide not to pay me that $100 prior to actually handing me the money.
Counsel, I was very interested in your interactions with the questions that the Chief Justice put to you on a step-by-step basis, where she first got you to agree to one premise and then agree to another premise. And one of the responses you said that essentially cutting to the chase in this case, what the plaintiff is asking is that the reasons for her termination be tried, correct?
Correct.
Right. So in an at-will situation, everybody has agreed the law in the state of Wisconsin is you can't try the reasons for your termination, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So if you can't try the reasons for your termination and the interpretation of the plan document is what we're looking at. In other words, when is she eligible for benefits? I don't really see how you step into the answers that you gave her, saying her right to benefits is set by the contract, not by whether she's an employee at will or not. Because in order, she got you to agree that every contract had an obligation of good faith and fair dealing. Well, the charge here is that the termination was not done in good faith and fair dealing, correct?
Correct.
I don't see how you can separate out the issues, so maybe you could try to do that again for me, because to me they collapse. If you say an employee at will can be terminated for any reason, as long as it's not a reason violative of the law, age or sex or something like that. So an employee can be terminated for any reason at any time. And then you got a contract, and you're saying, well, there's a violation of good faith because you terminated this employee so you wouldn't have to pay her benefits under the plan. That implies that if she were still an employee after the date of her termination, she would have gotten benefits under the term of the plan.
Well, I don't believe there is an implied duty of good faith and fair dealing in this bonus plan. Nor do I think
I thought that's what you told the Chief Justice, that you thought there was.
No, we were talking about, generally speaking, is there implied duty of good faith and fair dealing in a contract without distinguishing between employment. I do not believe there is an implied duty of good faith and fair dealing.
You don't think there's a contract here.
I don't think there's a contract.
Right. If it was a contract, then you would entertain the other.
If this were, for example, a traditional commission type contract, Then we'd have different facts before you. But as Ms. Phillips testified in her deposition, this was not a commission. This was a bonus.
Let's just put it into a commission and that you accrue the commissions every month.
Commissions are different,
though, I know,
Chief
I know.
Justice, than what
but
we're dealing with.
I'm getting to a bigger point. If this were a commission contract and they were accrued every month, right? And then there's a termination in year, in month 10, with accrued commissions, right? And we have a contract for commissions, right? With an at-will employee, right? Can the employee assert a contractual right for those commissions?
Following termination?
Following termination.
It depends on what that contract says. Well, if the contract's silent, then perhaps.
Right. But at any contract, there's at least an argument that it can. The at-will concept does not wipe out the contract. That's all I'm trying to get you to say. You willing to say that?
It depends on the specific language.
Absolutely.
Of the contract. Absolutely.
But you can have a contract that will not be wiped out just because it's an at-will employee.
That's correct.
And you can have a contract with an at-will employee that will include a good faith concept. It's possible. That's all I'm asking you.
It may be possible.
Right.
I do not believe
not
we have
one
before
one.
The court.
I understand that. Okay. Why is it illusory?
It's illusory because the bank could choose not to pay the bonus to her at any time. Prior to actually handing her the money, it can choose not to pay her the bonus.
Because it can get rid of it. Is it for her only or for everybody?
For everybody.
Right. So can they pick on her, or do they have to get rid of it for everybody?
And could they pick on her? They could pick on her if they're not otherwise precluded from doing so under Title VII, under the Age Discrimination Employment Act, under some other prohibition under the law. I suppose they could pick on her. But what they could have done is simply exercise their discretion that her performance was not satisfactory. Mm-hmm. And if she would have remained employed, not gotten this bonus, and then what? According to the Court of Appeals, all she has to do is go into court and say, no, my performance was satisfactory. I dispute that. And she gets a jury trial. And now we're going to have the jurors of the state of Wisconsin determining what's satisfactory performance in the workplace?
We do that all the time. If you have a protected employee that can only be fired for cause, the jury determines whether there's good cause. And one good cause is it's not satisfactory performance. Why are you so surprised?
Well, because we don't have any cause protections here.
I understand that.
Is she a protected employee?
No, she had no. She was an at-will employee.
Counsel, let me wade you over. Is that a verb? To facts. I have a couple of questions regarding facts. My first question is: was she on the payroll beyond October? I ask you
yes.
This. I ask you this is because someplace in here, I have the inference of this, that she, of course, requested temporary disability. She got temporary disability, I think, until January sometime. Correct me if I'm wrong on those facts. But let's say, I don't care if it's January or February. And that until that time, she was on the payroll. Was she on the payroll during the period of time for which she was also obtaining temporary disability benefits?
She received short-term disability benefits at least through the end of October 31st. And with that payroll check, she would have received payment of this bonus had she been eligible. Okay? Her employment was terminated on October 26th. Okay, just to back up a step, she had her questions. She had, we'll say, her grilling by Mr. Isaacson on the 19th. Mr. Janikowski was let go that same day. A couple business days later, Ms. Phillips decides she needs short-term disability. She needs to take off of work. A couple days goes by, the bank reaches its conclusion that it cannot trust her and must terminate her employment, called her, terminated her employment on October 26th.
There's something in the facts that suggests to me that she was allowed to remain on the payroll and collect her short-term disability benefits until mid-January 2008. I'm not sure I'm correct, and that's why I'm asking for clarification of the facts.
she may have received short-term disability benefits beyond the 31st. Mm-hmm. I don't know the specific date on which those short-term disability benefits ended.
But if she were receiving short-term disability benefits, was she still technically on the company's payroll during that time?
No, she was being paid through the disability policies, or through the self-insured disability policy.
Okay. Second fact I need clarifying is the whole payment of the bonus. And was it actually paid? I looked at the complaint here, and it said that it was paid and then it was taken back. Can you give me the facts relating to the payment of the bonus?
Yes. In Mr. Isaacson's affidavit, which is in the record at item number 17, you'll see the recitation of the facts here. He called her on the 26th, informed her she was being terminated. He informed Human Resources of the same, instructed that the bonus was not to be paid to her. And because payroll was already in process, the bonus was distributed to her on the 31st, but then pulled back out of her account.
It was put into her account on the 31st?
31st, I think.
Do you know when it was pulled out of her account?
That same day.
Easy in, easy out, huh?
Well,
I just say that.
I mean, the mistake was made.
So it was actually paid into her account and then withdrawn from her account.
Yes.
Counselor, I had that same question, and I had my clerk do some research on this before we came. And what was represented before is that there was a, quote, pay advice given to her about this $18,373, but the money never was put in her account. In fact, the pay advice was canceled, and what was deposited into her account did not ever include that amount. So that's a fact that at least what my clerk found for me differs from your response, and I'm wondering, do you know why we found a different response and we looked at the same issue than you're now telling us today?
I don't know why.
Okay.
I do know under these facts, though, we have, under the facts that are before the court, even if you decide to create this novel cause of action, the bank is still entitled to summary judgment. I mean, what we know is that the Code of Ethics specifically calls for not only proactive behavior, but also prohibits inaction intended to conceal relevant information. Intentional concealment of information, for whatever reason, will be considered a violation of the Code of Ethics. There is no dispute that Ms. Phillips knew all about Mr. Janikowski's plans. She participated in meetings with the entity that eventually became his future employer. He told her he was questioning the enforceability of his non-solicitation agreement.
Yeah, you're talking about something different, I think, than Justice Bradley and I were concerned about. We were concerned about whether there was actually a payment made to her, because the plan talks about actual payment. I mean, those are the words that you use. Those are the words that the plan uses. And so as a fact, it is important whether or not she was actually paid, whether the money was actually put in her account or not. Do you know where that factual dispute might be cleared up? Do you know of anything in the record that we can look at that would help support the fact one way or the other?
I am not certain of that as I stand here right now, but what I am certain of is that the important fact is whether or not she was employed on the date the payment was to have been made. And here, even if the bank mistakenly paid her, she was no longer employed. Her employment had been terminated.
Okay.
And that's the operative fact under the bonus plan documents.
So her employment was terminated on October 26th.
On October 26th.
And the termination was made effective immediately.
Made effective immediately. Yes,
and then you're basing that on, again, page 41, award payments. In order to encourage employee retention, participants whose employment with the company is terminated, and then we'll skip over the, well, voluntarily or involuntary for reasons other than a position elimination prior to the date of actual payment. So you're saying since the October 26th termination occurred, prior to the date, even if that money went into the account, that would be actual payment, but the position, she would have been, her employment would have been terminated prior to that.
Yes.
Thank you.
One issue I want to mention quickly is this whole concept of waiver. This is, I'm sorry. I see that my time is up.
You may. You've been hammered with questions, some relating to the facts. I don't have a feeling that you've gotten out what are your major arguments. So, counsel, if you would summarize your key arguments, and when summarizing your key arguments, this is a summary judgment case. And the key factor in Judge Fine's opinion was that there are issues of fact, including ambiguous contract interpretation. So give us your key arguments. And counsel, I'm hoping that we don't have to extend your time, but we'll do so for the very same reasons, but not others. You may proceed. Briefly, please.
In summary.
Exactly. You know what I had in mind.
I've already touched on many of my key arguments from the at-will standpoint. Okay, we are talking here about not just some sort of additional exception to the at-will concept, but really an abrogation of it. And if you look at the 37 other jurisdictions, the Maryland Supreme Court summed it up nicely and said, these are decisions left to the legislature. If we are going to inject this duty of good faith and fair dealing into employee benefit plans, we are turning the concept of at-will employment on its head. Waiver. This waiver issue is more than a mere technicality. The first time we ever heard of this implied duty of good faith and fair dealing claim was in a passing reference in one sentence in Ms. Phillips' appellate brief.
This is the waiver in terms of not raising it at the circuit
yes.
court. Go ahead, counsel.
Yes. Not only is it nowhere in the complaint, nowhere before the trial court, Ms. Phillips opened her summary judgment brief with the following. What this case boils down to is that U.S. Bank has withheld Ms. Phillips' earned wages of over $46,000 based on the false assumption that she had knowledge of a co-worker's plan to take away bank customers. Ms. Phillips, since day one, has been arguing simply that the bank was wrong. Not that the bank fired her to avoid paying her this bonus. Instead, we just see this passing reference in her appellate court brief. And the Court of Appeals jumped all over it. And Weaver is important because it denied the bank an opportunity to develop the factual record. It denied this court the opportunity to get the judgment of the trial court. The trial court was never allowed to address this issue. Finally, on the summary judgment issue, the Chief Justice is right. This is a summary judgment case. And the Code of Ethics required her to disclose this information to the bank, what she knew about Mr. Janikowski's plans. She knew all about these plans. We found out in her deposition that she never disclosed them to anyone at any time, even the two meetings she had with Mr. Isaacson on October 18th. So even if the court were to find that the bank has to justify its decision to terminate her for violation of the Code of Ethics, there is no dispute under the facts in this case that she has violated the Code of Ethics and that she's not entitled, if the court is to find that she's entitled to anything under this bonus plan, she's not entitled to be considered to be paid the bonus. I think that probably extended my summary, but I appreciate the court's indulgence.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Alan Olson, representing the plaintiff, Deanne Phillips. Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Justices. Thank you for having me. I'm Alan Olson. I represent Deanne Phillips. My colleague is attorney Nick McLeod. And during my oral argument today, I'd like to focus on five issues. First, how the covenant of good faith issue was presented to the circuit court. And then also how the contract was formed in this case, and then how this contract claim is distinct from a tort claim, and then how this reversal of payment of an earned benefit claim differs from a wrongful discharge case. And then finally, there are issues of fact that are in dispute that make summary judgment inappropriate in this case.
Okay. I'm going to start with the last one first. Just to clarify, a fact
that remains for me unclear. Your opposing counsel argues even if the bank paid her on the 31st, her employment had been terminated on October 26th. And so whether, when, and how long she was still on the payroll implicates perhaps when she was terminated. Do you know how long she was on the payroll of the company?
I cannot cite to that in the record, Your Honor.
Well, let me try this. This is the affidavit of the payroll specialist, Betty Eichelberger, and she's the payroll specialist with U.S. Bank. In paragraph 7 of the affidavit, she says, when an employee applies for short-term disability leave with the bank prior to his/her termination, the bank allows that employee to remain on disability leave and continues to compensate the employee with disability payments until the employee's leave is complete, since the bank's disability policy is self-funded. Phillips remained on short-term disability leave with the bank through mid-January 2008. From prior paragraphs, which I will not read, I inferred, someone will correct me if I'm wrong, that when the bank issued its payment, or whatever it's called, the pay advice in October, it was part full payment, and the bank issued under its pay advice part disability because it was self-funded. So that's what she got, a check, I assume, for part full wages and part disability, and that she continued, vermin 8 in the subpoena. Phillips Rooney remained on short-term disability leave with the bank through January 2008. Is this correct? Is it contested? Do you have any idea?
It is true.
And does it make a difference?
Yes, it is true that she was not compensated through a separate carrier. It was compensation through the bank, and it was through ordinary payroll, not as regular pay for work, but it couched in terms of disability pay.
So why is someone terminated but they continue to pay and on their payroll? It seems a little bit at odds. I'm sure there's an explanation, but it's not self-evident to me.
And it's not clear to me either, other than their conclusory statement that that's the way we do it here.
Well, if they'd had a third-party carrier and she was eligible for a certain number of weeks or days of temporary disability, she would have been paid by the third-party carrier, correct?
If that were applicable
here. And here the bank self-funds their temporary disability insurance payments for their participants, correct?
That's my understanding.
So it wasn't for services provided that she got the temporary disability, but as insurance payments for the disability.
Who knows? Why would somebody pay disability
for
somebody
when
they're already fired?
This isn't workers' comp where you get paid for a disability benefit. I mean, it looks to me like she's still on the payroll, and they're paying her for a short-term disability. I don't know, more than that.
This was for her health condition. She actually applied for family medical leave, as I recall, and took that and verified her health condition and was eligible for the benefits, and all that was provided to the bank prior to the termination.
Mm-hmm. Counsel, I'd like to take you back to sort of the first part of your argument, and it ran to contract issue. So is it your client's position that the 2007 U.S. Bank line of business incentive plan provisions constitute a contract?
Yes, it does constitute a contract.
If I look at page 41, under award payments. I'm sorry. I'd like to take a look at page 40 under award calculations. The second paragraph recites in part, the company reserves the right to withdraw or withhold from the plan any transaction, product, or service it might select, semicolon, revise territories, semicolon, establish specific account, client, or portfolio representation. And then the first paragraph says, occasionally events of an unusual nature may occur which result in a windfall situation. The company reserves the right at its sole discretion to adjust incentive awards for any event that distorts actual results achieved and or the participant's role and level of impact on the performance result.
Right.
How would that ever be measured by a court reviewing in contract? And how could that be called, something where one party here, the bank, doesn't retain all of the discretion to award at its will or not?
Well, that would have been the perfect place if the court had really intended to withhold money that was already delineated and earned by the employee to specify.
You said the court, but I think you mean the bank.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, by the bank, correct, that if the bank had intended to make that express provision, this is where it would have appeared, and they don't expressly provide for that.
They don't expressly provide for what?
For that, meaning that when an individual has already earned the money, it's already been deposited in their account, they can make a unilateral decision without the review committee's input to take the money back out of the account.
But doesn't that run to the sentence on the following page, page 41, under award payments? This is the part I discussed with your opposing counsel, Mr. Fulton. In order to encourage employee retention, participants whose employment with the company is terminated voluntarily or involuntarily for reasons other than position elimination prior to the date of actual payment are ineligible for an award. And so that would seem to run to the idea that if the employment is terminated prior to the actual payment, well, then the bank's not going to give any money.
Well, it also goes on to say, except for provided by state law, and specifically provided in the performance measure document. And also there's another provision in these documents that it is subject to review committee.
So which of those? Okay, so which state law? I mean, why is that relevant to your argument?
Well, it's relevant to the argument in that an employee in this, even though they're in an at-will employment relationship, they've got a duty of loyalty to the employer, for example. I see this as the responsive duty that an employer has to an employee where there's a contract to not, in bad faith, interfere with that employee's receipt of the money, especially after it's been earned 100%.
But here the bank, it doesn't seem to me they're resting their argument of her failure to abide by her part of the, by her responsibilities and not discussing Janikowski's plans on state law, but on the ethics provision or the guidelines that are handed out to all employees at U.S. Bank, or at least were at the time, and they include disclosure of any information that might touch or concern the bank's business. So the bank seemed to be pointing more to that specific agreement rather than to some kind of general provision of state law.
And that's where the bank ran into trouble on summary judgment, where there's a huge hole there. There's a disputed issue of fact on that exact point.
What's the disputed issue?
With respect
issue of
to
fact?
Whether or not there was a violation of the ethics code.
The disputed issue of fact is why was she fired, correct?
Was she terminated in bad faith so that the bank could keep her money?
Why was she fired? That's what is the dispute.
Yes.
Thank you.
What is the appendix has the, what's it called, line of business document. But there's also reference here to the performance measures document, right?
Yes.
What does the performance measures document say relating to the issue we're talking about, that is
accrual of benefits, non-accrual? What does the performance measures document say? Or don't you rely on that?
That appears at appendix number 43.
Let's see. Okay, let me just check that. Okay, what particular provision are you relying on?
Well, this lays out the...
There it is. Okay.
Who it applies to, the employees who are eligible to participate.
All right. Is there any particular language you're relying on? This document is to be used in tandem with the line of business, right? So you have to interpret these together, right?
Yes.
Okay. So what are you relying on here?
Well, this is a document that was distributed to Ms. Phillips. She was eligible. This is a unilateral contract. She accepted it. She did the work. Did it very well, obviously, earned the bonus, and this identifies her as an eligible participant in that program.
All right, and it's to be awarded and paid out over 4 quarters, right?
Yes.
In order to participate, there must be no outstanding performance-related issues in the following areas.
And the testimony by all of the managers was that she did an exemplary job.
Well, they fired her for a reason. Well, they don't have to have a reason.
That's true.
Okay. All right.
Is there any dispute that the employee was terminated on the 26th of October?
No.
Okay. And then there was some sort of payment at the end of the month, the 31st, was it?
Right.
31st. Did she get paid salary, whatever salary was due on that date, the 31st?
She received regular payroll. A portion of that, as I recall, was regular payroll. A portion was couched in terms of disability pay and as well as the bonus payment that was reversed.
When did she go on disability?
My recollection is approximately 5 days prior to the discharge notice.
Okay. Was that the first day of the pay period?
Wasn't it the 22nd? The 22nd, she advised she wanted to go on disability, I believe.
Okay. Page 4 of our brief, we're referring to record entry 23, that her leave began on a Monday, which is actually October 22.
Yes.
And she was called at home by Isaacson on October 26. Mr. Isaacson's actions in this case were unilateral. The document, the plan document at appendix page 41 specifically provides that the oversight committee will have responsibility for resolving discrepancies or problems, reviewing and approving plan awards.
Right, but
and in this case,
that
it was,
becomes relevant if this plan is a contract.
Right.
Counsel, just for your indulgence, please, following up on Justice Prosser's question, you indicate there is no dispute she was terminated on October 26th. And I ask your indulgence for this question. I just don't understand why the bank is paying leave from work benefits if she's no longer working there. So from my perspective, I want to know when is she, quote, unquote, no longer working there, according to the bank's records. I'm missing something. It's just counterintuitive to me that the bank would be paying leave payments through mid-January leave from work benefits if she is no longer working. So do you have a response to that that can help me kind of straighten my thinking on that?
And I'd add it also after Justice Prosser's question, she was terminated. We agree, that was a date that she received notice of termination. At that point, I think she's most accurately classified as an inactive employee.
She's on leave from work, I assume.
She's on leave already. She's being paid
by
the company through the end of her pay period, through the end of the January time period.
Complaint says U.S. Bank has failed to pay Ms. Phillips for the pay period of October 16 through October 31 in the amount of $3,077. I don't know if that was amended or...
That was amended.
There
was an issue of vacation pay, and through further discovery, that was clarified, that she was compensated for that time period.
Which time period? October 16th through the 20th? The 31st? Well, we can look that up.
The paragraph that I'm thinking of that was regarding...
paragraph 14 of your complaint.
Regarding vacation, yes.
I'm looking.
Well, actually, I have to correct myself. 13 addresses vacation.
Yep. I didn't look at that.
Is for the
pay period.
Pay period, correct.
And I read October 16th to mean maybe that's when she took leave on disability. But that's neither here nor there. That seems to be a fact question problem. Justice Prosser.
Was this a weekly pay period or a two-weekly pay period or more than that?
I don't want to venture a guess on that, whether it's biweekly or weekly. I believe it's one of those two.
Well, if she was paid on the 31st, that's a Wednesday. 2 weeks before that would have been the 17th. And she didn't go on disability until the 22nd. So if it's a two-week pay period, I would think she would have been paid for the 17th, 18th, any time before she went on disability with an ordinary salary.
That's my understanding.
Okay. It would seem to me that a court would evaluate salary payments and disability payments under different criteria than bonus payments. Is that fair?
The incentive pay was certainly under a specific written provision.
Well, I mean, was
that
this,
the company provided and she relied on in response and did the work.
Was this a
certainly
commission?
Different than,
was this a commission or a bonus?
I think it really is a matter of semantics. I know there's been discussion on both sides as to whether there is some substantive difference between the two.
Was it twilight or is it night, to use the phrase? Is it twilight or is it night?
In my opinion, it's twilight. It's not night and day because she did all the things that a commissioned salesperson would do. Aside from having her $80,000 salary, the $47,000 in pay was derived directly from her selling of the new accounts.
Did she apply for workers' compensation benefits?
No. She didn't have a work-related injury.
Did she apply for unemployment compensation benefits?
I don't know whether she applied for unemployment compensation. If she did, she would not have been eligible until she was available for work. So that would have had to have followed, by definition, the disability period.
What was the nature of the disability?
I can't recite the specifics of it.
Is it relevant?
The implication, I think, from Justice Bradley's question is that because the bank paid disability payments beyond the 26th, that somehow that should be held against the bank. It seems to me you're not relying on that argument.
It's not being held against the bank, other than she received a call from the same person who took the money or ordered that the money be taken out of her account, said she was terminated. We don't dispute she got notice of the termination. Whether, in fact, it was a termination on that date while she was still on leave and an inactive employee, and then we've got the payroll affidavit that was read into by Chief Justice Abrahamson that leave status continues on. I don't think it's being held against the bank.
No, but isn't the implication is that if she got the disability, she was still an employee, and the contract says she gets these, whatever you want to call them, bonus, commission, et cetera, if she's still an employee at the end of the year, right?
Right.
And so if the fact is that because of the disability payments, she is still viewed as an employee, even though she's been told that she's been terminated, got a little factual question and an interpretation of the contract. I think that is what the implication is, and you haven't argued that. Neither side has argued that issue, right?
Right.
Neither side knows what her status, at least they're not telling us, is through disability. And the court is trying to get the facts straight. And here we are into, I don't know how many minutes of your argument, and this is a summary judgment. A summary judgment isn't given if there are material facts in issue, right?
Yes.
Are there material facts in issue other than this disability issue which the court has raised?
As mentioned earlier, there's the issue of the contract interpretation, if there's any ambiguity in the contract.
What's the ambiguity?
We don't say it's ambiguous. The defense says that the oversight committee provision is ambiguous. They're also claiming that the contract is illusory.
That's a legal
issue. Different issue. And as I'd mentioned before, the issue of her violation of the ethics code when she was not even asked the questions.
Well, they think she violated the code, therefore she forfeits her money.
Right.
You think it's a question that has to go to the jury, whether she violated the code? When I say jury, fact finder.
Whether the bank used that as an excuse just to keep her money.
Did she violate the code?
She did not violate the code. The deposition testimony is clear. She wasn't even asked the questions or alleging that she lied about. And she was an excellent employee. She gave testimony that she was very clear, that she had no intention of participating in or taking any clients from the bank.
So that's an issue, a fact as you see it.
Yes, Your Honor. And if I could use it just briefly my time to the extent it's important to the court, there was a claim by the defense that this issue came up for the very first time on appeal, and the record would show that that was not the case. In fact, in summary judgment, the defendant raised the case of Willis versus Champlain Cable, where an employee could not recover commissions for sales that were made after the employee's discharge. In response, at pages 9 and 10 of our summary judgment brief, we cited the Lean versus Butter case. That's a Wisconsin case that cited Willis, the case that was relied on by the defense. And Lean held that the termination must not be in bad faith. That is, it must not be done in order to avoid paying what would otherwise be due. We also argued at summary judgment our entitlement to present facts to the jury that Ms. Phillips was terminated in order to allow the bank to keep her money. With respect to the pleadings that initiated the lawsuit, it's not in the complaint for the specific reason that there's a breach of contract claim in the complaint, and there is no basis to allege the covenant in the complaint as a cause of action because no separate cause of action for good faith exists. Good faith merely directs attention to the party's reasonable expectations. It is not an independent source from which rights and duties evolve, according to the Court of Appeals in the Howard decision. Then in our scheduling conference data sheet we filed with the trial court and we served on defense counsel, we raised the issue of the termination of employment. We raised Ms. Phillips's reasonable expectations regarding the contract and identified that the bank's refusal to pay was a breach of the contract. In opposing the motion for summary judgment, we did submit sufficient facts that showed there was a real controversy. And the trial court could have addressed it, but when we look back at the transcript from the oral argument on summary judgment, the trial judge indicated that was not a matter that needed to be dealt with because there was no entitlement in the first place. This court has the discretion to review an issue that, even if it had been waived, if it involves a question of law, as long as it's been briefed and it involves a public interest. And reversing payment of earned benefits certainly is a public interest. The bank also had an opportunity to make an argument on summary judgment on this covenant of good faith issue, and it did so. In its brief, in both of its briefs, in fact, at the trial court, the defendant argued that it had sued Janikowski for breach of the code of ethics. And now the bank is claiming it never or would have taken that opportunity had it had the opportunity. It clearly was exercised. Therefore, a decision should be made on the merits of this claim.
How do you answer the reasoning that Brockmeyer and a whole series of other cases in Wisconsin say you can fire for any cause, good, bad, ugly? I mean, you can't violate public policy, but I don't see any violation of public policy here. You're not arguing that, okay? So the rule is, as to Ms. Phillips, they can fire her for any cause, right?
Yes.
Okay. You're not conceding that. I mean, you're not arguing that.
We're not arguing it. We're not arguing that this ruling would disrupt that narrowly defined doctrine in any manner.
You're not arguing you have to overrule Brockmeyer and that whole line.
Absolutely not. No, and not an expansion of that doctrine.
Right. Well, but the reasoning I hear from the bank and from members of the court in questioning you or questioning either one of you is now you have not the contract of employment, but you have a contract within at-will employment that offers a benefit,
right?
Call it whatever it is, but it's a benefit of extra compensation, right?
Yes.
And one argument is, not the only argument, one argument is that benefit contract within at-will employment, the benefit contract has a good faith implied term. And that in dealing with that benefit contract, the employer has to exercise good faith. In other words, can't fire just to avoid paying the benefit.
Yes.
Right? Okay. Now, You have an at-will contract, no good faith required, right?
Right.
Within that at-will employment, you've got a separate contract, and you want to put in good faith. And that seems inconsistent, right? No good faith for the big contract or the big at-will employment, but good faith for the contract for the special benefit. So why isn't that inconsistent? Why isn't that undermining Brockmeyer or the whole line of at-will cases?
It's not inconsistent, and I think it works fine as a practical matter in that we have a defined contract that we're dealing with that's within the employment relationship. We're not seeking to redefine the open-ended at-will employment relationship. We're only looking to the defined contract itself, what the rights are of the parties. I see I have a red light at this point.
You can finish.
And so this position is supported by the restatement of agency and the restatement of contracts, as well as the civil jury instruction 3044, where we're looking at the parties' mutual responsibility to act in good faith when they carry out the terms of a defined contract, in contrast to employment at will and a wrongful discharge case that looks for post-discharge remedies. Here we're looking for only the remedies arising from the employment relationship.
So you're not looking for reinstatement, so Brockmeyer is fully compliant with. What you're looking for is a contract separate and apart from the at-will relationship.
Correct.
Which comes out because there's employment anyway.
Yes.
Okay. Would you like to add anything else since I gave time to the other side?
No, thank you, unless there are more questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, counsel. Mr. Fulton, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Chief Justice Abramson and Justice Prosser, you're absolutely correct. Ms. Phillips has never made this argument that she was still on the payroll or still an employee as of October 31st and therefore entitled to payment of this bonus, because the material facts are not in dispute. She was terminated on October 26th. Now, backing up, U.S. Bank pays on a bimonthly pay period. That's why this allegation in the complaint is from the payroll period the 16th through the 31st. Okay, paychecks come on the 31st and the 15th. So on the 31st paycheck, she received payment for wages up into her salary up until the date she went on disability leave. She then received disability benefits pursuant to the short-term disability policy under which she had made a claim, and she erroneously also received payment of the bonus, which went in and out of her account almost simultaneously. Justice Rogensack, in answer to your question from before, the money did go in and out of her account. She was informed of it simply through a pay advice. So she never had use of the funds. It wasn't as if they sat in her account for a day or two. She used them, and the money then got pulled back out.
What kind of account?
I believe a checking account, but I'm not.
Okay. So it was something that belonged to her. Money was put in by the bank into that account and withdrawn immediately. And a pay advice is a communication from the bank to her about what they did.
Yes.
And what they did is put it in and take it out.
Yes.
So that was the advice, not that she was entitled to X amount of money.
It was simply...
It was that an in-and-out transaction in her bank account that the bank did unilaterally.
Yes.
Not to be confused with a unilateral contract.
Correct. I think it's a slippery slope to start saying that someone who's receiving disability benefits pursuant to a self-funded disability plan is still on the payroll of a company.
We don't have the disability plan in the record, do we?
I don't believe we do, because it was never an issue.
Your opposing counsel indicated it was, as I heard him, family medical leave. Do you know anything about that?
I don't recall if that's the case. What I do know is she applied for short-term disability benefits. They were granted to her pursuant to the bank's short-term disability policy. And if the bank were not self-funded, she then would have received payment from a third party for those disability benefits.
And that plan might have said only as long as you're employed, or it might have said for 5 months after you're employed. We don't know that.
Exactly. Okay. What we do know and is not disputed is that her employment was terminated on October 26th, and therefore she was no longer eligible for consideration to be paid the bonus on October 31st. Ms. Phillips talked a bit about responsive duties. I want to take a look at this from the other angle. If there's going to be this implied duty of good faith and fair dealing in this bonus plan document, it's got to go both ways. I mean, let's say that Ms. Phillips had decided that she had taken a job, accepted a job somewhere else on October 1st, but she's decided that she wasn't going to start until November 15th. And she received payment of her bonus on October 31st and turned in her two-week resignation the next day. Would she have been acting in good faith in receipt of that bonus? She had already accepted employment elsewhere when one of the stated purposes of the bonus plan is employee retention. Would the bank have a claim against her for violation of the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing?
Maybe that all has to be sorted out at trial.
But there aren't any material facts in dispute.
Well, there is one if she acted in good faith. There's another if the bank acted in good faith. And a third is, do you see any ambiguity in this contract?
I don't think there's ambiguity, but to the extent there is any ambiguity, Dave Isaacson testified that this is how the plan has always been applied. No employee who has been terminated has ever received payment of the bonus. He also testified that he has reduced payments that someone might otherwise be eligible for in the past, using his discretion. And what we're talking about here is having juries determine whether or not someone violated a code of ethics, whether or not someone is in good standing, whether or not someone has been a satisfactory performer, all in an at-will relationship. That flies in the face of Brockmeyer. It flies in the face of McKenzie. I mean, look what the court did in McKenzie. As abhorrent as it is, the court recognized that employees and employers lie to each other all the time about their intentions vis-a-vis future employment. Okay? Yet, with the good in at-will employment comes the bad. And the court refused to recognize a cause of action in a scenario like that. How can there be any other greater example of bad faith? And I see my time is up, so thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Justice Klassen, do you have a question? Thank you, Mr. Fulton, and thank you, Mr. Olson, for your arguments today in another case involving employment relations and, whether it's tangential or central, the Brockmeyer line of cases. That concludes our hearings for today. The court is in recess until tomorrow when it will hear its final, I think it's three cases, on the November docket. And the court will meet in closed conference at 2 o'clock. Is that enough time for you all? Those who are staying for a discussion with a justice will remain in courtroom, and the justice will be out in just a few moments. We are in recess.